Before we start the podcast, we should tell you that Overlooked was created for adult audiences. It contains descriptions of violence, death, and sexual acts that might be triggering, so please take care of yourself when listening. Also, if this is your first time listening to Overlooked, go back and start with episode 1. The story is meant to be heard in order.
Previously on Overlooked.
I took my son to see what the police wanted. I believed in the system. And they said, give them 15 minutes. And I did, and I didn't ever get my son.
What I do understand and know is, without accountability, that kind of stuff will continue to happen.
Team Rock, the social justice group chaired by rapper Jay-Z, says they're applying more pressure to the Department of Justice, urging them again to open up an investigation looking into what they call a pattern of corruption by the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department.
I don't know if he even remembered her. He had so many black women on his list. She was just one of countless.
It's November 2021, and it's a cold morning, but Nico Quinn is fuming hot. I meet her in the parking lot of a suburban office park where she's going in for a deposition in the Lamont McIntyre case. Again.
I feel like this is a waste of my time. Don't want to be here.
I'm walking fast just to keep up with her, to keep up with the long list of people who have been affected in Lamont McIntyre's case after he spent 23 years in prison for a double murder he didn't commit.
I found out that this case is for Lamont and Rose, his mom. The compensation, because they're suing the Unified Government and KCK Police Department. It's not about justice or accountability to me. It's about financial gain, and I don't want to be here for that.
As you might remember, since this conversation, Lamont and his mom Rose's federal lawsuit against the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department and the local government was settled for $12.5 million. But that's not enough for Nico Quinn, who's still seeking justice for her cousin, Little Don, who was murdered in April 1994, and for many murdered women. Another important thing that has happened since this conversation? Well, lead detective on the case, Roger Golubsky, was arrested by the FBI on charges stemming from allegations that he sexually assaulted and kidnapped a woman and a teenager back in the 1990s. But Nico and others have their doubts about whether Golubsky will ever be held accountable for everything he's accused of.
I really don't feel that Golubsky or nobody will be held accountable.
Nico is so passionate about holding Golubsky accountable because it goes beyond the murder of her cousin, or Lamont, or his mom, Rose. It's deeply personal because Nico says Golubsky victimized her big sister, who was murdered.
Like I said, I don't think that nobody will be convicted for my cousin's murders, and maybe not even for my sister's murder. So I believe they're going to walk away. And I don't want to be here. I'm in a messed up mood. I haven't been asleep because I'm not ready for this.
Now, Stacy Quinn was murdered in 2000, and Roger Golubsky investigated that case, too. Somebody went to prison for that crime, but Nico still has a lot of questions about the investigation.
It has to be so frustrating. I mean, you've been dealing with this for how many years?
28. April will be 28. And I don't believe that it's going to be, I don't believe it's going to be any justice. Don't want to be here at all. At all.
It's been 28 years since that double murder on Hutchings Street. Since Nico Quinn was a 21-year-old mother being threatened by a prosecutor with the loss of her kids. Since she didn't tell the truth the first time she testified. But she quickly tried to right that wrong when she told everyone that Lamont McIntyre didn't kill her cousin. So on this day, Nico Quinn will sit in a sterile conference room in a beige suburban office park, and she will tell the story again. Because people are trying to piece together how Golubsky got away with his behavior for all those years. We've told you about Roger Golubsky and the many black women he's accused of abusing. They're often referred to as Golubsky's girls. Well, this episode, we're taking a little detour to get to know one of them, Nico's sister, Stacy Quinn. Certainly not enough attention was given to her life. or her murder for that matter. And Nico wants the world to know who she and so many other women were and how Golubsky impacted their lives.
My sister can't speak. None of the women can speak. So we have to be their voice. We have to be their voice because I can just imagine that they're not resting, especially if what people were putting out here is not true about what happened to them.
I'm Peggy Lowe, and this is Overlooked, a podcast from KCUR Studios and NPR's Midwest Newsroom. In this third episode, the story of Stacey Quinn, just one of the women Roger Golubsky is accused of exploiting for years, and how her murder mirrors others being investigated by the FBI.
Sometimes people go through something that it's hard to get out of.
Stacey Quinn had a hard life. There's just no other way to say it. She was born into the large extended Quinn family in Kansas City, Kansas, in 1968. Her mom suffered from mental health problems. Josephine Quinn was in and out of her daughters' lives from the time they were young. And yet, Nico, the baby of the three Quinn girls, smiles when she remembers their childhood. Stacey was 4 years older than Nico. Then there was Leela in the middle. The girls liked to pretend they were musical sister acts.
Oh my goodness. We used to act like we were basically the Jacksons, or I say something like the Braxton sisters. We all sit there and sing together, play church. When my mom got sick, Stacey always act like the mama. She took that place. Her and Leela, they were both like my mother.
The girls were taken in by their grandmother, her name was Cinderella, who made sure that they went to school and church. But things went south for Stacey at about age 16.
I mean, we were all just close until Stacey got on the drugs. When she got on the drugs, she became a whole nother person. But she was the sweetest person you want to know when she wasn't on the drugs.
Nico says Stacey started with wet, or PCP, and ended up on crack, partly as a way to deal with the sexual trauma they both experienced during their childhood. And just a warning here, this is really hard to hear.
My uncle, we had an uncle, we had two uncles that used to rape us when we were little.
I'm so sorry, Nico. Jesus. And so you think that's why she turned to drugs?
That is. Because she took it the hardest, because she used to try to protect me and my other sister, and they used to beat her up.
That's horrifying. Did you guys not tell, like, your folks?
When it came out, what goes on in his house stays in his house. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. One of those things.
That's hard to live with.
Oh, yeah.
Stacey tried to make a good go of it. She wanted to become a nurse and was working as a certified nursing assistant for a while. Nico says Stacey hoped to become a licensed practical nurse, but the drugs got the better of her. When she was 15, Stacey had a son. She named him Jornell. Jornell remembers they moved around a lot when he was a kid, and lots of times they'd stay with his grandmother, Josephine, his great-grandmother, Cinderella, or with his aunties. There was an especially good few years around the time Jornell was 10 years old, when Stacey had a boyfriend named Cleveland. Jornell never knew his last name, but says he was a nice guy. They all lived in a big old house, and he had all the video games he wanted, like a real family. But it didn't work out.
Why did they break up?
Because my mom started using again. Man, she was, I guess, acting crazy or something. But he didn't really, he didn't want her to go. But she was just like, she wanted to leave. And, yep, and they broke up.
Jornell also knew about his mom and the white cop, Roger Golubsky. He'd see them riding around town, but he was just a kid at the time.
I'll be out playing basketball or something, and she'll be like, "That's my son right there, Punky." That's what she used to call me. And he said hi. You know, that was the first time I seen him. And then the second time, Rod was riding by, and they was going, I guess he was dropping her off at my grandma's, and I be like right down the street playing basketball with my friends. And he'd honk his horn and wave at me.
Golubsky started preying on Stacy when she was about 15 or 16 years old, according to her family. Nico and her other sister say that Stacy first crossed paths with Golubsky when she was walking home one day after work. He picked her up and he raped her. Stacy's story bears resemblance to a separate allegation in the current federal indictment of Golubsky, in which he allegedly raped an unnamed 13-year-old girl, then kept doing it for years. Here's Nico talking about Golubsky and Stacy's relationship.
They messed around. She was saying that he had arrested her for prostitution back in the early 90s. That's when he started putting her in jail. Maybe it was something he wanted that she wouldn't do or she wouldn't give him. That's the only thing I can think of.
Was it a true relationship? I mean, did she actually like the guy?
No. I don't know.
Stacy's aunt, Frida Quinn, says that Stacy's relationship with Golubsky was common knowledge, that all the Quinns knew what was going on with them. In a 2011 affidavit, Frida Quinn said Golubsky would pick up Stacy at her mom's house. She'd be gone a few days, then come home with new clothes and money. Golubsky, however, did not divulge the relationship in police records, a fact that would become evident on April 15, 1994, the day of the double murders. That day, Stacy maybe had the best view of the double murder. She was in the house and heard yelling coming from the driveway. It was her mom arguing with her uncle. She went to the door to tell her mom to come inside. Her mother ignored her. And that's when Stacy saw a man dressed in black, carrying a shotgun, coming down the hill, walking towards a Cadillac. Her cousin Little Don was sitting inside.
My mama was like in the driveway and she kind of ducked down. And I remember Stacy came out on the porch, like on the, maybe the first or the second shot. And she started holding her hands. Oh my God, it's Little Don. Oh my God.
By that time, all the Quinns were outside, just a few feet from the Cadillac.
And Stacy was going ballistic.
Now, given the fact that Stacy was right there that day, that she had witnessed the double murder from just a few feet away, you'd think she'd be one of the main witnesses the police would want to talk to. But Golubsky, the lead detective on the case, never interviewed Stacy, steered clear of her even. His police report sounded like he didn't even know her. You probably remember how the story goes next. Golubsky turned to two other eyewitnesses, Nico Quinn and Ruby Mitchell, to put an innocent man in jail. But Stacy was around the whole time. Nico remembers her big sister also being at the courthouse when she was waiting with Golubsky to testify at Lamont's first trial.
And we were sitting in that room, and he was telling me that he heard that I was a dancer, and he wanted me to stand on the table and strip, and how he wanted to get to know me. And my sister was telling him, she kind of like put her hand in front of me and she was telling him, this one right here, you're gonna leave alone. And she told me don't ever go around her because he was the devil. She called him a snake.
Stacy Quinn was trying to protect Nico. And no matter what Stacy was going through in her oftentimes chaotic life, she tried her best to be there for her little sister when she needed her. Like when Lamont McIntyre was convicted and Nico realized what her testimony had done, Stacy helped Nico try to make it right. In 1996, when there was a new effort to try to get Lamont released from prison, Stacy filed an affidavit that said she saw everything on April 15, 1994, and that, quote, I got a clear view of the man's face, meaning the shooter, and he looked nothing like Lamont McIntyre. In fact, Stacy had heard on the streets about who the killer supposedly was, Neil Edgar Jr., nicknamed Monster. Now keep in mind, Edgar has denied any involvement, but Stacy was afraid of him. For years, she avoided him, staying away from certain places and keeping close to people she thought could protect her. Yet, even though she was afraid, she said she'd be willing to point out who she believed the real killer was, so that the right person would be punished for the murder of her cousin Little Don. She had a brief chance when Lamont McIntyre appealed his case, and it went back before a judge in 1996. Stacy appeared in court that day in jail fatigues. She'd been in lockup in another county because she violated parole on a theft charge. But Nico says the judge and the prosecutor, Tara Moorhead, the same one who threatened Nico in 1994, they dismissed Stacy's testimony.
The first one we encountered, he talked to her like she was lord in dirt. Lord in dirt. They talked to her so bad it wasn't funny. They called her all kind of crackheads and everything else.
In fact, the judge said he didn't believe Stacy, that she was, quote, a felon and an habitual drug user. Stacy testified that day that she typically smoked crack four times a day, although she hadn't the day she saw her cousins killed. But here's the thing. Stacy was like many women who grew up under tough circumstances. She grew up poor and abused. And then she was, according to her family, victimized by Roger Golubsky early in her life, while still a teenager. Her story has patterns similar to a host of other victims' stories, according to their families and a federal indictment against Golubsky. The pattern was this. Golubsky would see a vulnerable teenager or woman, pick them up, and then abuse them for years. They wouldn't talk about it because he had threatened to kill them or jail them or their loved ones if they told anyone. Sometimes he'd also give them drugs or promise them his protection. But here's the other thing that a lot of us are still trying to wrap our heads around. A lot of these women ended up dead and in a certain part of town. More on that after the break.
From the pandemic to climate change to elections, there's a lot going on in Kansas City right now. You can get it all in one place at KCUR's daily news podcast, Kansas City Today. My name is Nomi Nujiadeen, and I bring you stories from KCUR's award-winning newsroom. We cover the issues that matter to you, like housing, criminal justice, and education. You can subscribe to Kansas City Today wherever you get your podcasts.
Last year, I rode around the north end of Kansas City, Kansas, in Wyandotte County, with Nico Quinn and activist Khadija Hardaway.
I'm feeling pretty good about what we're doing.
Khadija is the founder of Justice for Wyandotte. It's a group trying to help victims like Nico and all the other people who've been affected by the McIntyre case.
My main thing is to stay as close to Nico as possible so that, you know, her health stays healthy and that she can move on successfully.
But on this day, they're trying to explain to me how Roger Golubsky ruled this area.
We were talking, and we was talking about how he used to, how he was messing with Stacy back then, and how he messed with all these women, and he just taunted, like, black drug dealers or blacks in a hole.
What do you mean black drug dealers are in the hole? Like, he was just trying to get the dealers?
They owed him money.
Oh, owed him. I see.
Like, had a
well,
debt.
Basically, he had a hand in it, is what I'm saying. Like, he, something you would see on TV that he had to get paid. Whatever was going on, basically, he had a hand in it. He was getting paid. If you get, he get, where's his cut?
Stacy Quinn was very much a part of all that. As we're driving around, it's a maze of streets with rundown houses, many abandoned. And we turn onto Faro Street, where Stacy Quinn's body was found.
So the guy's car, they was parked on this street right here. So she was down here on this dead end somewhere. This is a dead end of the street.
The last time Stacy's son, Jornell, saw his mom was 2 days before her murder. He was 16, living with one of his aunts. Stacy was cold that day, so Jornell remembers giving her his red, white, and yellow Kansas City Chiefs jacket.
She gave me like $150. I was like, here you go, baby. And kissed me on my forehead. And that's when she left.
The night she died, Jornell was out at a teen club where he had run into a lot of her friends. He remembers they all said the same thing to him.
All that night. So when I got there, like everyone I seen that came by, I was like, your mama was just looking for you, you know.
Stacy was looking for Jornell, but they never ended up finding each other. because after he left the club, Jornell was hanging outside with friends when...
We chilling on the porch, and that's when we heard all them shots.
Because there was a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot of shots. And it sounded like they put another clip in the gun or something, because it was a lot of shots. You heard it, then you stop hearing it for a second, then boom, they start shooting again. Like, I don't know what happened. But yeah, it was right around the corner from where we stayed at.
He didn't know it at the time, but those were the shots that killed his mother. That Sunday morning, January 16th, 2000, Stacy Quinn literally ran into a dead end. People who lived on the block told police they heard about 10 shots. Then they heard a woman begging for help. Then another volley of about 10 shots.
We were told that she was begging the person, not the people, not to kill her. She said she wanted to go home. She wanted to go to her son. She wanted to go to her family. That she was yelling, please don't kill me, don't kill me. And he chased her. And as he was chasing her, he was shooting her.
Stacy made it to the front door of a 90-year-old woman's home who'd been watching TV in her living room. Bullets came through her front window and broke a ceramic lamp. In the police reports, a couple witnesses say they saw a 6-foot-tall black man wearing a short black coat. He was running and had a gun. When police arrived, they found Stacy Quinn face down at the woman's front door with shell casings near her body. There were more shell casings in the street, along with one of her shoes and a white plastic bag with her stuff in it, some clothes and a book. Another shell casing was found under her leg. Stacy Quinn was 31 years old. The detective who came to the scene that night was Roger Golubsky, the man Stacy herself had described as a snake. The police report says he got there at 2:30, an hour after Stacy was killed. His report, much like the one he wrote on that 1994 double homicide on Hutchings Street, didn't acknowledge that he'd known Stacy and the Quinns. The autopsy report revealed the staggering amount of time Stacy Quinn was shot. In all, the coroner found 21 bullet wounds. While they were undressing her, a bullet fell out of her jacket. Another intact bullet was found just lying on her neck. In her pocket, there was some makeup, a tube of lipstick, a toothbrush, and condoms. She'd been wearing the chief's jacket her son Jornell had given her 2 days earlier.
Then the next morning, we all met up over my great-grandma's. And that's when Golubsky came, and he was like, Stacy Quinn was killed. But he was acting like he didn't know who my mama was, you know. And it was kind of weird to me, and I was young, and I really like, hold on, I used to see you with her, so you know who my mama is.
It was moments like this, experienced by the Quinn family over years, that led them to distrust the way Stacy's murder was investigated. Now here's how it played out. Golubsky and his partner focused their investigation on a car that was parked near the crime scene, a 1998 black Chevy Cavalier. It had a dent on the driver's side, bullet holes on the passenger side. They went to the car owner's apartment, a young woman, and found her boyfriend there, a 22-year-old named Marcus Washington. They also found a .40 caliber Sturm Ruger and a lot of ammunition. In Golubsky's report, Washington said he'd been driving home that night when Stacy flagged him down and asked for drugs. He said she asked for a ride and they stopped at a house. Washington said he waited in his car outside and then suddenly was hit by another car. He thought it was a man who had twice tried to kill him. He was terrified of this guy. Washington told police he thought Stacy was setting it up. So he grabbed his gun, but he said Stacy fought him for it. Washington said Stacy had a small gun and she fired at him. He fired back. She took off running, he followed, and she ended up at the front door of Farrow Street. The prosecutor on this case was a familiar one, Tara Moorhead. Yeah, the same one who said she would take away Nico's children if she didn't falsely ID Lamont McIntyre. Moorhead showed up in the middle of the night to the scene of Stacy Quinn's murder, and she prosecuted Washington. At his trial, Washington testified on his own behalf. He admitted shooting Stacy. He said he emptied the 15-bullet clip on his Ruger. But he said it was in self-defense, and a psychologist testified that he had PTSD because someone had tried to kill him twice. Washington was convicted in October 2000. He got a hard 50. That's a Kansas law requiring a mandatory minimum of 50 years in prison for premeditated first-degree murder. Washington's now 45 years old and in a Kansas prison. His earliest possible release date is January 2050. Despite that conviction, Stacy's family still has many questions about her murder. For instance, Nico and her sister Lila say that when Golubsky notified the family of Stacy's death, she asked him about reports that Stacy was seen riding in a red Jeep with a white guy with a ponytail on the night she was killed. Lila says in the photos they showed the family that day, a red Jeep was at the crime scene, but I couldn't confirm that.
I did my own footwork, and they told me that my sister had been riding around with a white guy with a ponytail, with a long trench coat on, and I had. That's what we've been hearing for years. That's what we heard when it first happened. We didn't know nothing about no black man until they came and said they found the killer, and it was Marcus Washington.
Nico says Golubsky told her, don't worry about that red Jeep. But it did come up at Washington's trial. Under questioning from prosecutor Tara Moorhead, Golubsky testified that a red vehicle in a crime scene photo belonged to a resident on Farrow Street, but that he never found him to interview him. Now, was that sloppy police work or something else? There's another thing that bugs Nico about Stacy's whole story. Shortly before she was murdered, she took a plea bargain in September 1999 on a cocaine possession charge. The charge would have put Stacy in prison for at least a year, well past when she was killed. But court documents show that Stacy got out in just a couple months.
Before she got out of jail, she called me and told me she needed $100. When she had just told me days prior, because I would go visit her, that they were supposed to be shipping her out to someplace in Missouri, some women's prison in Missouri or Topeka. And they was just waiting on room. I know they had room to send her, but she never left.
Stacy was kept in the Wyandotte County Jail. Nico says the judge told Stacy she needed to get clean and that she would be in prison for a while. But all of a sudden, she's getting out. Nico called her other sister, Lila, that day.
I called Lila to tell her what happened. By the time I'm hanging up the phone with Lila, Stacy walking in the door, and I'm asking, how did she get here? How you get here? I got a ride.
The ride was from Golubsky, according to Nico.
He got her out.
Yeah, and drove her to my house.
And the Quinns aren't the only ones that think things don't add up. They've heard from many people, including people who were out on the streets that night, that they don't believe the police version of events in the murder of Stacy Quinn. Nico says she was told they were involved.
And being in the streets and what I was involved with, I know what they mean. They is not no you, me, or nobody like that. They is the police. That's what they is.
If Stacy Quinn was still alive, she'd be a grandmother.
I want to get you on tape here. And last name's Quinn.
Yes, ma'am.
Q-U-I-N-N, just like all the other millions of Quinns.
Yes.
Over Stacy K.
Stacy's son, Jornell Quinn, is 36 years old now. He has three kids. His oldest, a daughter, just graduated from high school. I first met him at Nico's apartment. He was watching the Kansas City Chiefs game that day, wearing a T-shirt with his mom's picture on it. Little Don's picture was on it, too. Jornell mostly wants to remember the good things about his mom, like how when he was little, she called him Punky, and they'd color together, and they'd go to the park, and she could do a backflip. He's still good at chess because of her, and they love to dance.
Mama used to always dance with me. Just nice, you know, nice things that was going on there.
There was one song Jornell especially remembers, such a kid song.
It was a lot of songs, though, but I can't remember all of them, but I always remember that one. Because that was back in when everybody was wearing their clothes to the back and things like that. She used to dress like me. Well, I used to dress like her, and we had to go on the dance floor and just be dancing and spend a little time together.
Jarnell is clear-eyed about his mom. He knew she was often on the streets and that she used drugs. And he loves her deeply.
Yeah, it didn't matter if she was on drugs or anything. I had, like, growing up, I had a lot of friends that, you know, mama used, and they'd be ashamed of it. But, you know, it's life. Sometimes people go through something and it's hard to get out of. And, you know, I accepted it what it was.
Life didn't get any easier for Jarnell after his mom's death. He was convicted on a federal drug charge in 2006 and was in prison through 2011. He lives on the Missouri side of Kansas City now, hoping to stay away from old temptations in KCK. Hardest days of the year are in October, her birthday, and on Mother's Day.
Like, if you wanted the world to know something about Stacy Quinn, what would you want the world to know?
That she was a good mother, no matter what, like, our use or whatever it was. She was a good mother, and she made sure she raised a good boy. That's what I say. Well, man, now, yeah, I say she raised a good man.
Jarnell's trying to face what he's been through. His Aunt Nico is always after him to talk about his mom. But people don't really understand. Meanwhile, Nico is the exact opposite. She talks about the case all the time, and she's also trying to provide some solace and services for more people in KCK. She calls it her spiritual sister's circle.
Well, I basically came up with that because my sister's name is Stacy, and I want to use the S as spiritual sister's circle. And it's for people that were like her, that have been through a rough childhood, don't have nobody to talk to, because right now it's a financial crisis. Nobody have the finances to get counseling, get help, or even people's time. And what I want to know is people's story and try to help them talk through it.
The women get together occasionally to remember their friends and to pray. They've walked around to the sites near a part of Quindaro called the Ruins, the remnants of the town that was once there, where more bodies of black women have been found under mysterious circumstances. Nico says someday she might even open the group up to men.
Just being a sister to these women, and maybe later on help men as well. Because I didn't just lose a sister, I lost a cousin, I lost an uncle, I lost friends. So what I'm trying to do is get justice for everybody.
Getting justice for everybody would mean reopening Stacy's case, Nico says, to further explore Golubsky's role in her sister's murder. And there are some things about Stacy's murder that don't add up. Marcus Washington has never recanted his admission that he shot Stacy in self-defense. But I've read hundreds of pages of documents in this case and interviewed the family members, and there are a couple odd things. First, Marcus Washington said Stacy Quinn had a small gun, but there was no record that it was ever recovered. There were casings from a 25 caliber gun found in the street, but Washington used larger 40 caliber bullets in his Ruger. That's mysterious to me. Second, the autopsy says that a red tube top was, quote, retained archivally in the morgue freezer. Not one of the police property reports listed a red tube top among Stacy's things. And if the case was so locked up, why would they keep that? And what about that red Jeep Stacy's family heard about from people on the street? I don't have the answers, but even if I did, they won't bring Stacy back or give closure to her family. What we know for sure is that Golubsky, working as a detective in Stacy Quinn's murder, someone he allegedly exploited for years, is highly inappropriate and something, according to police records, he didn't divulge. We also know that Stacy's story is a lot like other women whose cases I've looked at, women known as Golubsky's girls. What had been a term used to describe them on the streets back in the day has since been adopted by social justice activists to talk about this group of women. They got with Golubsky at an early age, connected by sex or drugs or his use of confidential informants, and they ended up murdered, their bodies found in the same area where Stacy was killed. And Golubsky's involvement in Stacy's investigation says a lot about the KCKPD and their lack of supervision of one of their top homicide detectives. I've told you about how the FBI is investigating Golubsky right now. But what I haven't told you is that the FBI also investigated KCKPD back in the 80s and 90s, questioning their integrity, their practices, and their violations of civil rights. And right now, all of Golubsky's cases are under scrutiny. District Attorney Mark Dupree has suggested he would review every case Golubsky touched, because along with a list of murdered women, there are also many black men who are in prison because of Golubsky, but say they're innocent. For decades, Roger Golubsky used his own playbook to clear cases fast. But all of these years later, will he finally be held accountable? Coming up on Overlooked.
For my work, they were definitely racist because all the people they were picking on, you know, were the blacks in the hood. Because what are those people going to do? They really don't have anything. They don't have any recourse. You can't go into the Kansas Police Department and say, this cop is stealing my drugs and my money, rather than you're going to go to jail.
And that's when I would go to him and he would say, they're liars. He would say, they're drug dealers. They're scum of the earth guys. He said, and naturally, they're not going to be honest. So who am I to believe?
We are here to take the deposition of Roger Golubsky.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you, God?
I do.
You saw black men making money through the drug trade in Kansas City, Kansas, and you wanted in on the action, correct?
You know, you heard so much about this man, Roger Golubsky. I just wanted to know, what does he look like? Who is he? So I paid a call. I went out to his house.
So I just rang the bell.
Overlooked is a production of KCUR Studios and NPR's Midwest Newsroom. It's hosted by me, Peggy Lowe, and reported by me, Steve Vakrat, and Dan Margulies. Mackenzie Martin and Suzanne Hogan produced, mixed, and did the sound design for the podcast, with editing by CJ Janovi and mixing help from Paris Norvell. Digital editing by Gabe Rosenberg. Social media promotion by Allison Harris. Photos by Carlos Moreno and Julie Deniche. Artwork by Krista Henthorne and Chandler Johnson of Kalamazoo. Music from Blue Dot Sessions and Chris Cross. Special thanks this episode to Jean-Vive Desmarteaux, Lisa Rodriguez, and Holly Ejo. Overlooked is part of the NPR Podcast Network. For more information on this case, along with photos, evidence, and documents, go to kcur.org/overlooked.